me tell you about a product that I am using personally, and I really think this works. You know, beetroot juice has been used by Olympic athletes for its stamina-boosting effects, and studies show that it can increase athletic performance and stamina by 16%. So call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeets.com and you can get a 30-day supply free of this great product. It comes with your first order and it's backed by a money-back guarantee. 800-738-2198. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Today's podcast is on a new book, The Digestive Health Solution, by today's guest, Dr. Benjamin Brown. He's a naturopath in the UK. And the subtitle is Your Personalized Five-Step Plan for Inside-Out Digestive Wellness. We covered a lot of topics in part one, so I urge you to, if you haven't already, to listen to part one. In part two, I'd like to cover some of the specific nutraceuticals and treatments for IBS and for this condition. But before we do that, Leah, let's talk in your book about the role of exercise and the role of sleep. They seem to have an impact on IBS.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, often with digestive health, we neglect bigger sort of lifestyle behaviors, and sleep and exercise are just classic examples of that. So, you know, the link between IBS-like symptoms and exercise, unfortunately, hasn't received a lot of attention. One, because there's not a lot of profitability or commercial sort of rationale for, you know, investigating exercise. But as we both know, it's a really profound determinant of our overall health. And this is very true for digestive health. So we do have a few good clinical intervention trials now showing that advice to exercise in people with IBS can actually result in significant improvements in their symptoms. And we think the reason for this is in part because it improves gastrointestinal function, motility, improves the transit of gas and elimination of gas, and just improves overall health. So can be really useful as an intervention. Now, the link between sleep is perhaps even more profound in that we know that your gastrointestinal tract undergoes a diurnal circadian rhythm. That means that it's regulated by day and night cycles. So it turns out that, you know, the release of, you know, hormones that occur at night, like melatonin, also occur in the gut and influence digestive health, which is pretty remarkable. But on a more practical sort of link there, it turns out that people, you know, who undergo shift work or, you know, are perhaps flight attendants and have real disruptions to their sleep patterns, have a really high
jet lag. Travelers, you know, people who fly to Europe, and, you know, they're all messed up in their bowel habits.
Exactly. Yeah. So these people have really high prevalence of digestive problems. And we also know that sleep restriction studies have shown that they will exacerbate digestive symptoms. And there's a lot of good evidence to show that at least melatonin can be a useful treatment in people with sleep problems and IBS-like symptoms for you know, providing relief. So it is a really interesting story, the sleep connection there.
Yeah, that's one we really didn't suspect, but only recently did it come to light that melatonin can actually help with IBS. So, and the dosage is as one would provide for sleep, 1 to 5 milligrams taken at bedtime.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so taken about 9 p.m. and that seems to result in improvement, particularly in people who have, you know, disrupted sleep patterns or report insomnia-like symptoms.
So let's look at some common remedies. One of which, you know, I really learned something from your book, that there's really a science to this, because one of my favorite supplements for patients who are constipated is a product called Flowe, P-H-L-O-E. Maybe you don't have it over there in the UK, but what it is, it's an extract of kiwi.
Yeah.
And I know that you're from that part of the world. You're not from New Zealand, but you know a thing or two about kiwis.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Flowe's a great product, and basically, kiwi fruit's an interesting story. It's actually a Chinese gooseberry, but it was commercialized in New Zealand. And early on in Auckland, it was noticed, I think, in one of the nursing homes there, that regular consumption of kiwi fruit actually improved gastrointestinal health and started to relieve constipation. So was picked up, this observation, by the University of Auckland, and they went on to conduct a clinical trial, you know, some years ago now, and one of the first in that area. And they basically found that, you know, whole kiwi fruit, two or three a day, you know, within a few weeks will relieve constipation, improve gut symptoms. And since that initial study, several more have been conducted on whole fruit. And as you rightly point out, kiwi fruit extracts are becoming, you know, well studied now as well. And they seem to work really well, including in people with IBS. So there is a good clinical study in people with IBS showing it, you know, improves regularity and as a result of that, relieves digestive symptoms. So
but it
pretty
appears
interesting.
To be gentle. It's not like, you know, if you drink a lot of prune juice, you know, or have a lot of Uncle Sam cereal, you know, you're going to be running to the bathroom. This is sort of a gentle regulator, possibly because it's a prebiotic, that's my understanding, or is there some chemical in there that's that is helpful?
Yeah, it's spot on. So it is gentle, and it's not a strong laxative. It's not like prunes are full of sorbitol, which can cause a bit of gas and discomfort. The way kiwi fruit's working, as you rightly point out, it is prebiotic, so it tends to improve the gut microflora. But there is also an enzyme in there called actinidin, and actinidin is a proteolytic enzyme, much like papaya or pineapple contain enzymes, but it also seems to be a regulator of gastrointestinal motility as well. So as well as helping break down food and digest food, it also tends to improve gut muscular contractions and function. So it's quite an interesting fruit for digestive health.
So moving right along, we also have digestive enzymes, and in some cases people quaff hydrochloric acid preparations. What's your take on those?
Yeah, so hydrochloric acid is a really old sort of nutritional treatment, and it seems to work quite well in people who have symptoms where it appears they have low stomach acid, and that would typically be feeling like food's kind of sitting in the stomach and not being digested, a much more common symptom with older age as well, because hydrochloric acid in the stomach tends to decline, mostly due to atrophic gastritis with age. So that can be quite useful. It very quickly acidifies the stomach and improves digestion of food and can help relieve some symptoms in those individuals. And then enzymes are a bit different in that they, you know, typically digestive enzyme products will just, you know, contain things like lipase, amylase, and protease, and they will help, you know, break down and digest food too. And they've been recently studied in IBS only in the last couple of years. And what's been noticed is that people with what we call pancreatic enzyme insufficiency, which can be tested, you know, with a stool test. You can look at fecal elastase 1. And if you supplement someone with low fecal elastase 1 or pancreatic insufficient with enzymes, you know, guess what? Their symptoms improve. And this can be a really effective treatment. So that's a great one too.
Well, let's take a segue to testing, okay? I don't know that you have the same tests available to you in the UK that we do, but you've been stateside and you've seen, you know, if you work with some of the integrated practitioners in the States, what are some of the tests that might shed light on the cause of a gastro problem?
Yeah, I mean,
because you mentioned the stool test, and that's one component of that comprehensive stool test, the elastase.
Yeah, exactly. So I think to be fair, the most useful sort of single, actually, there's a few tests that can be really useful for IBS. The one is like a comprehensive digestive stool analysis, where you're doing a stool culture and also looking for, you know, other markers like fecal elastase 1. And a good comprehensive profile like that will look at a few things that are really revealing. One of them is the overall balance of your gut bacteria, a bit more than just a conventional parasitology test. So it'll give you a real insight into whether there is just overall dysbiosis, I guess you could say. And then, you know, it'll pick up things like fecal elastase 1, and you can also look at, you know, potentially the presence of low-grade inflammation with something like calprotectin in there as well,
A point on that. My understanding is that it's now felt that there is not like a Berlin Wall between IBS and ulcerative colitis, that, you know, we say, well, you don't have colitis, you have IBS, but it's a continuum. So some people literally have bleeding and they have like craters, you know, ulcerations that you can see on colonoscopy, whereas an IBS patient might have what looks like a non-red, smooth intestinal wall, but they may have some features, if you look under the microscope, of IBD or colitis.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a really great point, and this is really, you know, on the tip of the emerging science here. And, you know, for a long time, it was thought that IBS was this kind of mysterious, distinct disorder that had no real, you know, underlying pathology. But it turns out, and, you know, you're exactly right, that it is part of a continuum. So, you know, although if you do colonoscopy and a biopsy, you know, or conventional sort of inflammatory marker testing, you tend not to find any elevations or even, you know, results on examination in someone with IBS, it doesn't mean it's not there. It's just that these tests aren't sensitive enough. So experimentally, we know it is there. But with more sensitive markers, you can see inflammation. It's definitely present in IBS versus healthy controls. Now, it turns out that IBS is emerging as a risk factor for inflammatory bowel disease. So there's a significant increase in risk. And what that is suggesting, as you point out, is a continuum. So it seems that IBS is a mild inflammatory disorder of the gastrointestinal tract that could potentially increase your risk for something, you know, much more serious over time. And, you know, these inflammatory bowel diseases are, you know, very serious illnesses.
So, you know, back to testing, we have the stool test, the comprehensive digestive stool analysis. What else might shed light?
Yeah, so I think another important test is looking for IgG markers of food sensitivity.
I'm glad you said that, but I didn't prompt you to say that. But it's a test that I use. I know it's a controversial test. Conventional allergists don't like it, but you know, my good colleague who's been a guest on this program, Dr. Jeannie Drisco, has actually written a paper on how this helps us pin down food culprits that may be triggers.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think, you know, this is a really, you know, good example of a test that is gaining weight. And it's, you know, it's one of these practices that we've used for years and years that, you know, is getting more and more evidence to show that it actually does really work, you know, beyond our clinical experience. So, I mean, the way the IgG tests work, as you know, is you tend to identify a few key top allergens or sensitivities based on elevation of antibodies. And then you can use this test to construct a personalized elimination diet. So you'll tend to eliminate, you know, say the top six foods that come up, and people get better. You know, that's the bottom line. And beyond IBS, which has been shown to respond very well to this approach, and a lot of these studies are cited in the book, it results in improvements in loads of other things as well, like, you know, skin diseases and headaches. And, you know, there's evidence for, you know, all sorts of areas, and even inflammatory bowel disease. There's some great emerging evidence in that area as well. You know, so it does work. I think it's really useful, even though it's still considered a bit alternative. I think that's slowly changing.
There's intestinal permeability.
Yeah. Intestinal permeability is an interesting one. It's a bit of a tricky one to assess clinically. So you can do the classic, you know, lactulose mannitol test, but it is considered a bit insensitive in a sense, that you may still have, you know, elevated blood endotoxin, you know, that's clinically significant, that won't, you know, you're not necessarily directly attesting with this.
Depends where you are in the United States to where the availability of those types of tests that measure the presence of antibodies to endotoxins, and that's kind of esoteric. But, you know, you can drink a solution we use in our office, and as you say, it's a bit insensitive. I suspect some of the patients who turn out negative on that test have leaky gut to some lesser extent, but it will uncover irregularities in absorption or leakage of intestinal contents.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's still, you know, clinically relevant and one of the best things we have. So, you know, that could be a really useful test also. But I think in general, your comprehensive, you know, digestive stool analysis, looking for your enzymes, inflammation, and IgG sensitivity are great. And then, you know, as you pointed out earlier, using a breath test to pick up SIBO can be really useful as well. And beyond that, lactose intolerance and gluten sensitivity are key ones to look for.
And some of the profiles offer what are called dysbiosis markers. They're urinary metabolites that sometimes suggest overproduction of bacterial end products that are supposed to stay in your intestinal tract, but they don't they ultimately get sequestered in your urine and they come out.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's quite a few different ways you can measure gut microflora imbalances, and you know, urinary markers are one, and there's all sorts of different ways the stool can be measured as well, through, whether it's through DNA typing or culture analysis. So it really depends a little bit on what's available in your area and, you know, what labs you're using.
Well, so coming back to common remedies, we talked about digestive enzymes. Peppermint oil is a popular one. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so peppermint oil is an interesting one. It's often forgotten, but peppermint oil has been used for decades, mostly in Germany. There, I think from last count, there are over about 20 clinical studies published on peppermint. It's one of the best studied natural products for the relief of IBS-like symptoms. And basically, the take-home here is, from a clinical standpoint, is that it works really well. It's typically administered in a dose of around 0.2 mils in an enteric coated or delayed release capsule three times a day. And it seems to work through a few mechanisms. One of them is that it improves gastric emptying, which can be a problem in IBS. So there's a delayed stomach emptying, which could be linked to symptoms. It also tends to have an antispasmodic effect. And interestingly, it also is antimicrobial. So there's a published case study suggesting it reduces SIBO as well, which is might explain in part why it's working for people. So it can be a really useful treatment. It does take a little bit of time. It can work, you know, instantly, but for, you know, some people, they need to stick with it for a few weeks to start to see, you know, really good improvements. So that's a nice one.
There's also what are called carminative herbs. I believe peppermint has some carminative effects, but there's a whole category of traditional herbs that are carminatives. What does that mean?
Yeah. So carminative is a term that's really used to denote an effect of herbs that's sort of calming down or reducing spasm and pain and discomfort within the gut. And, you know, and a lot of these studies are cited in the book. There's quite a lot of different herbs and herbal preparations, mixed herbal preparations that have been studied in IBS. And, you know, some of these key herbs are things like chamomile and ginger and peppermint and caraway seed are, you know, a key ones that have been looked at. So these herbal preparations do have some evidence and can be quite useful for calming down, you know, symptoms safely.
One formula that we get from Europe, I believe originated in Germany, Iberogast. Uh-huh. Is that a popular formula for IBS?
Yeah, it is, and it works really well. I mean, the predominant evidence, clinical evidence for Iberogast is for functional dyspepsia, but there are a couple of really good clinical
studies.
There
was the belching and like sort of bringing up, stomach contents kind of thing, like regurgitating.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, you know, what people commonly think of as like acid reflux. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it seems to work very well for IBS as well. So pretty, you know, fantastic formula for that.
And there's the category of antibacterials. I know there's an overlap because peppermint has multiple properties, but sometimes we go at the gastrointestinal dysbiosis with things like garlic, oregano. How about those? Berberine. These are those types of things.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's an interesting story there. So basically, these herbs, antimicrobial herbs, have a really long traditional use for improving gut symptoms, and there's emerging evidence to suggest that they do indeed selectively kill off gut pathogens and could be useful for SIBO. And unfortunately, it didn't make it into the book because the study was published just after I handed in the manuscript. But Jerry Mullen and his group at down at Johns Hopkins University published a great report. I think it came out in Global Advances in Health and Medicine last year. And basically what they did was they compared the effects of these herbal type combinations to the antibiotic treatment you mentioned, and basically found that it was as effective, in fact slightly better, for eliminating SIBO based on a breath test, and had fewer side effects. So these herbal treatments are really valid and can be quite useful.
Any familiarity? I looked it up in your book, but I didn't see it. It was bentonite for diarrhea. Are you a fan of that? That's a type of clay.
Yeah, to be honest, I've no real personal experience with it, and I don't know enough about it to really comment. But are you using that clinically and finding it effective?
Or? Sometimes for people with chronic diarrhea, it's highly absorbent, and it tends to pull toxins into it, and you know, sort of and it firms the stool generally. And actually, some of the even things like. What's the popular anti-diarrhea remedy? It's actually got.
Like Imodium, I guess.
Imodium is more the thing that works on the nerves, but some of the even the over-the-counter remedies contain clays, literally, that are bind the stool and absorb toxins.
I mean, that's great. I mean, if it's working really well, and I think the cool thing about bentonite, like as you point out, is it may be having. You know, important effects on improving gastrointestinal health as well by binding up toxins and sort of cleaning up the gut a bit. So it makes sense to me.
Meditation as part of a lifestyle modification and even hypnosis, can they have an impact on this?
Yeah, they do. And there's a lot of work showing that, you know, stress reduction techniques will reduce IBS symptoms. The way I look at it is like this, is that you know, there is a bidirectional relationship between these gut symptoms and your mental health. And, you know, it works both ways. And I think people with established IBS often have significant anxiety. And that sort of sets up this sort of snowball or perpetual cycle type effect where the, you know, the gut symptoms are causing mental health problems, which then further exacerbate the issue. And, you know, while I don't want to, you know, dismiss IBS as being just in people's heads, it turns out that you can use these mind-body interventions as really effective ways to not only reduce the anxiety symptoms, but also control the gastrointestinal symptoms. And there's a lot of interventions that have been studied. And these include, you know, talk therapies like psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, but also really simple things that people can self-administer as well. You know, so simple deep breathing exercises and meditation exercises have all been shown to have important benefits on, you know, reducing anxiety, but also improving gastrointestinal symptoms.
Well, all this information is fantastic, and you'll find it in The Digestive Health Solution, a book just out, the author Benjamin Brown. And do you have a website?
Yeah, so you can hit the digestivehealthsolution.com, and I've also got a website with a blog, which is timeforwellness.org, where you can follow me on Twitter and Facebook, etc. there.
Timeforwellness.org.
Yeah.
All right. Well, to borrow a term from across the pond, this was spot on. I really enjoyed our conversation, and you know, you nailed it, as we might say over here, because this is a very, very pervasive problem, but it yields itself very nicely to a systematic approach, like a little detective work, you know, some turning yourself into a little bit of a science fair project, trying. Some of this advice can help get people out of a vicious cycle and act as a circuit breaker for this chronic problem. So congratulations, great book, and thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure. The Digestive Health Solution by Benjamin Brown. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.